Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we again sample the work of students in the radio narrative journalism class at BU's College of Communication. We begin with the world of music. Musicians the world over share a unique language that allows them to come together to perform, even if they come from wildly different backgrounds. Student reporter Sophie Eisenberg talked with some jazz musicians about the meaningful connections they get to make.
Jaira Kahlo lives in a large house at the end of a dead-end street in Boston with five other musicians.
Hi, Sophie.
Upstairs is a series of carefully arranged rooms with furniture that is just worn enough to feel cozy and well taken care of plants lining every window. Her bedroom doubles as a home studio with recording equipment and instruments on every surface.
from the house, because we were doing a cleaning and somebody was, this is like previous roommates probably, and I was like...
At 24, Kahlo has released two EPs and earned a bachelor's and master's degree from the Berklee School of Music, one of the top jazz programs in the world. But she hadn't received any formal music training until moving here from the Philippines in 2015, in the dead of winter.
The snow was like covering cars and they had to dump snow into the ocean because there was just no space.
Oh,
were you here for this?
No, I wasn't.
Well, that was my first experience of snow and I was like outside.
Is it always like this?
Kahlo's earliest memory is of singing in a school musical at age 2.5 back in Metro Manila, where she grew up. She doesn't remember a time when she wasn't making music.
So like, I grew up with my mom, my sister, and I like singing three-part harmonies. And like I was always trying to find the other voice. Like, how do I fit there without copying what they're singing?
This habit of finding a place for her voice among other voices may be part of what attracted Kahlo to jazz. As a style of performance, jazz leaves a lot of room for free expression. But it also relies on musicians to understand each other on the spot and find a path they can walk together.
If you had to try to explain that kind of communication to somebody who doesn't know anything about music, what would you say? What would you compare it to?
A conversation, if done right, because that's, I think, the heart of improvisation, especially when you're improvising with other people, is that, and especially in a jazz setting, the ones that do it well are the ones who not just are able to flow with what they want to say, but are also listening to each other. And that's why sometimes it's through the musical setting that people find that connection that they may not experience in normal social settings.
The realization that each wandering passerby.
Even when she's not improvising with others, Kahlo often chooses to perform without a planned set. She calls this strategy preparing to be present.
You allow yourself to be a lot more vulnerable. So whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking, that's what you express. Because if you have something prepared, I'm going to rely on what I prepared versus what I'm presently feeling.
According to Kahlo, learning to be present and vulnerable in this way equips performers with a valuable set of emotional tools that can be used both on and off stage.
It boils down to that, how we deal with our emotions. Because there's nothing wrong with having fear. There's nothing wrong with being afraid. There's nothing wrong with being sad or angry. But how we use that and how we acknowledge it. And 'cause anger can be used to create change and drive you to do incredible things, or it could drive you to do really horrible things.
Kahlo's always working on new material, but hasn't decided on when to release her next album.
I could just release what I have, but it's like, for me, it's what does it do? Like, how relevant is it? Is it really gonna help someone? It's not about the music, you know. It's like the music is just a tool for sharing our humanity. Because without that, it's like, what's the use? Like, what is it for?
I'm Sophie Eisenberg.
I see an old man sitting on a park bench, looking in the sky, when he can see the mouth stench of the range of people walking, talking nonsense. the park. I see a man sitting there.
Latin jazz is a music genre that's difficult to completely pinpoint. Its influences include Cuban mambo and American jazz, rooted in music from Africa. Student reporter Mariana Sanchez-Gauna has the story of how it's growing in Boston.
Fabiola Mendez started playing the cuatro when she was 6 years old. The cuatro is similar to a guitar, but with five double strings. The body resembles a number 8, but the top is smaller than the bottom. Mendez is the first at Berklee College of Music to graduate with the cuatro as an instrument.
I think the sound of the cuatro is definitely something very different. So for the jazz world, jazz is always about improvisation, about fusion, about creativity. So I think having this instrument in jazz is definitely something that talks to the meaning of jazz itself. And in terms of Latin music and the cuatro in general, I think is taking the instrument out of the box, as I was saying, out of the tradition. And even though I'm very proud of the tradition and I always want to play the tradition, I think it's important for the younger generations to keep the instrument relevant and to keep moving the instrument forward with the times and with the music industry so that we don't lose, you know, we don't lose it.
Mendez, who's from Puerto Rico, performs in a small church in Matapan. Afternoon light floats through the window, and people in the church are bobbing their heads to the music. It doesn't look like your typical house of worship.
I would describe my music as Latin jazz, definitely. I do a lot of folk music from the island, but mainly when I write music, I like to fuse it with jazz and Brazilian and Afro-Cuban and have all these influences.
Afro-Latin heritage has significantly influenced music in Caribbean countries like Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Dominican Republic. Latin jazz is rooted to Cuba's West African tradition, American jazz, and Cuban-specific rhythms like the rumba.
I think it's everything. I mean, for us in Latin America, it's all about the groove. So definitely the Afro influence of the groove of the time, of the swing, as we call it, the rhythms, all of these things I always incorporate in my music. I think the harmonies can come more from a Western European tradition. So I do a little bit of both, you know, but definitely the groove and the swing is essential to my music.
It's far more than just groove and swing that are influenced by Afro-Latin heritage. Another Berklee student who's well aware of that influence is Sheila Del Bosque. She's a flutist whose trio played at Copley Square as part of the Boston Book Festival earlier this year.
Music now is like a mix of all these worlds. I have this background of classical music because actually in Cuba our system is based in the Russian school. In the case of woodwinds, also we have a lot of influence of the French school. So I have this classical world, I have the Cuban music, of course, with, rumba, song, and I have the jazz tradition of American influences. So I have the Afro part. So I have like all these mixes, and I think that's what I want to do, like mix all these worlds and create something different.
Mendez and Del Bosque, with their respective bands, say they're proud to bring the music of their countries to new audiences here and are eager to find out where the genre goes next. I'm Mariana Sanchez-Gaona.
The long-running 80s and early 90s television series Cheers told the story of a Boston bar where everybody knows your name. That was fiction, but student reporter Anxi Zhang found a real bar in Brookline where that spirit lives on.
It's 5 p.m. on Friday, and cafes and restaurants on Harvard Street are still preparing and waiting for their rush hour. Matt Murphy's pub is already packed. The manager and bartender, Snowy Murphy Queen, has already finished her dinner and joins the pub's lively night routine, scurrying among tables, talking to guests over the pub's din.
Can't believe that so much happened in one night. Yeah, every single night feels like, doesn't it, 2 weeks.
Matt Murphy's pub is an Irish pub, serving lunch and dinner. From the outside, it looks more like a flower shop with flower baskets. Inside, big and small family photos line the wall. The pub is unusual. No Wi-Fi, no TV. You don't need a reservation and can only pay in cash. You see more women here than in other pubs. All but one of the bartenders are women. So are more than half of their customers.
The photos on the wall are friends and family. These are my sisters and I in Ireland, and some photos from pubs in Ireland, and this is a picture from my wedding. That's our friend Sharon.
Queen points to the old photos on the wall, a record of her life and her family over the past 25 years. She still remembers the day her parents bought the storefront. She was there from day one and grew up with the pub. 5 years ago, Queen took over the business from her mother. Now, the pub is her baby. She says she would sleep in the pub if she could.
If you're spending the time to really like look at people and get to know them and notice them, not just as a customer or a number or trying to make money, you have to think about it in a different way. This is unique. This is like a family. You can't bring the wrong person. It's like a stranger came to live with you in your house.
One of the newer employees at Murphy's Pub says she already feels like she's been working there for years. Rita Doherty is a waitress and bartender.
One time, one of our regulars, she decided to cut his hair at the bar, and she gave him a haircut right here after too many glasses of wine, and he had a big top of hair missing from the back of his head. That was a good story.
Three women and a man are sitting at the round table beside the window. They are regulars. One of them, Deborah Troderman, has been coming here with a group of mothers for the past 13 years. It began when their kids were in kindergarten. Now they are freshmen at Brookline High School.
My kids come here all the time. And the great thing, when the kids come, Snowy knows exactly what our kids want to eat. She puts their order in right away so that they can eat. And then they often go over to the little park playground over there at the Korean church and play. But kids are coming and going usually.
The mothers are loyal regulars at the pub. They say that's because of the owner.
It was Snowy. The first time I came here, I felt like I was at home, and she just completely took over and started taking care of me.
Snowy.
It's like a game show. Snowy, hey. Snowy. There's two really festive nights. Snowy's birthday. Everyone comes in and gives her gifts. All this cakes and champagne on the bar. And on Christmas Eve, same thing. Everyone's bringing gifts in, even if they're not staying. They're coming and hugging her and giving her Christmas gifts. And it's just the most warm and inviting place to be.
This is a warm. In the winter, this place is like a glowing, warm place. It surrounds you like a cocoon.
It's like a cozy sweater.
A home away from home. A place where everybody knows your name.
Trying to make her pub like a home, Snowy Queen doesn't care if people just order one beer and sit here for 4 hours. It's easy to understand why everyone, employees and customers, feel at home at Murphy's Pub. They can be their true selves. For Queen, it doesn't matter how much you consume. What matters is how happy you are. I'm An Qizhang.
Good evening again. On tonight's broadcast of Boston University's World of Ideas, we're hearing stories prepared by journalism students in BU's College of Communication. Next up, stories of rising rents and economic challenges in our community. It's not just residents being pushed out of the area by rising rents in Greater Boston. Nonprofits and arts organizations are struggling too. Student reporter Kaya Williams has the story of one longtime fixture in Cambridge that has had to close its doors.
For 28 years, the narrow hallways of Green Street Studios were filled with the sounds of contemporary dance performances, comedic dance shows, community coming together. But in October, the music stopped. Green Street Studios could not afford rent that was tripled under the building's new owner earlier this year.
I keep comparing it to, like, your, like, childhood home where, like...
Eliza Malecki was the studio manager at Green Street.
You want to, like, move out eventually, probably, but you also don't want it to go away because, like, the feeling of it not being there anymore, it just, like, is heartbreaking.
Malecki is a contemporary dancer who used the space for rehearsals and classes. When the studio closed, she wasn't just out of a job. She also lost out on one of the few spaces in the city where she could practice her art.
You look at any other space in Boston, and like as like an emerging artist, like I can't afford to rehearse there. I can afford to rehearse at Green Street.
The building housing Green Street Studios sold earlier this year for $12.3 million. The threefold rent increase is now considered market rate. Business was actually pretty good, but the steep jump in costs wasn't one the nonprofit could sustain while keeping classes affordable for the dancers who practice there. Tariq Campbell is a hip-hop dancer and a choreographer who taught classes at Green Street Studios for the past 8 years. After more than a decade in Cambridge, he's witnessed the city's changes firsthand.
And you see it. I mean, you see these really beautiful looking, you know, high rises or condo complexes and developments going up. And they're really pretty. I mean, they make the city look really nice, but they're really out of reach for a lot of people here.
But at least for now, that's not the plan for the space that used to house Green Street Studios. Nearby Goodwill still has a few more years on its lease. But the city's landscape is changing, and Green Street isn't the only casualty. Last year, musicians were evicted from Central Square's EMF building to make way for developers. And the year before, the art gallery Out of the Blue 2 left high-rent Central Square for more affordable Alston. Campbell says there's a price to pay for all of this development.
There's something about the loss of that culture that comes with this rising cost to be living or operating in Boston and Cambridge.
That's not to say the city isn't trying to help. In October of last year, a newly created arts task force began 9 months of meetings to find policy and funding solutions for the Cambridge arts community. Jason Weeks is executive director of the Cambridge Arts Council. That's a city agency that funds arts organizations, and it helps them present artists' work. He says that by working with new businesses, not against them, the city can get ahead of the problem.
So the more we know about that, the earlier we can get involved and try and create a situation that is both and not either or, so that we support our creative community at the same time, you know, developers are able to do the work that they're eager to do.
As for Green Street Studios, nothing is set in stone. But Weeks says negotiations over a new home continue. Despite developments that make it increasingly difficult to survive as an artist in the city, Weeks is hopeful about the future of arts in Cambridge.
Arts and art making and artists and our whole creative industries are very nimble and they're also robust. And so, you know, I also remain optimistic that we'll continue to find, you know, that sweet spot to make both things work, you know, that we can continue to develop and we can continue to grow the city.
But no matter how adaptable arts organizations can be, there's only so much the city can do. The future of Green Street Studios is still uncertain. And as rents continue to rise, it's getting harder and harder to survive as an artist in Cambridge. I'm Kaya Williams.
Skyrocketing rents and property values are bringing a change to Boston nightlife. A bar in the city's Fenway neighborhood will soon close to make way for residential dormitory space. And it's not just any bar that's closing. It's one of Boston's oldest gay bars. Student reporter Christian Yeager has this look now at the impending closure of Machine.
Machine, known previously as Ramrod, has been on Boylston Street for decades. It's one of the oldest gay bars in Boston.
Machine, to me, is like family.
Meet Donald Smith, one of Machine's head bartenders.
Closeness of the staff. Humbling ourselves to our customers so they can come back.
Smith feels that the loss of Machine is a loss of community. And he's not alone. Marco Baldessari, who lives nearby in the Fenway neighborhood, worries there will now be limited options for drag nights in Boston.
It's unfortunate that we're losing a place for our community to gather, to celebrate, to see our friends, and in most cases our families. It will be missed.
Baldessari, along with thousands of other drag spectators and performers, wonder where they will go once Machine closes. Clubs are out there, but they seem to be disappearing one by one.
One of the things that I'll miss is our Monday nights, our drag nights in Boston, which is historically have been on a Monday night. And previous to Machine Mondays, we've had Access. When Access closed, that drag night moved over to Machine, so it'll be interesting to see where that goes from here.
Access, another gay club in the Fenway neighborhood, closed its doors in 2007. Before that, it was the Paradise in Cambridge, and several other gay clubs that shut down.
While Paradise was sold by the owner for personal and business reasons, Machine was forced out by a developer. The closing of Machine in the Fenway area a year after the closing of Paradise in Cambridge points to a trend in the disappearance of bars that cater to a gay audience.
Roberta McLeff is a Boston University professor in women's, gender, sexuality, language, and literature studies. She says gay culture has become straighter.
Over the years, it seemed to me that gay couples were more interested in traditional marriage style lives and everything that comes with that, sort of monogamous marriage, one-on-one relationships, adopting children, and emulating sort of middle-class heterosexual couples' norms.
Another frequent guest at Machine is Nicholas DeLima.
I continue enjoying the identity that this place tries to preserve for many other clients, including the younger generation of not only gay people, but people that identify themselves with this place regardless of their sexual orientation.
DeLima says the closing of Machine is an end of an era, but the beginning of a new one.
Many that are here are going to meet somewhere else. We're going to meet elsewhere. You know, I know that. You know, we're going to meet maybe in a stray bar, because I go to stray bars nowadays.
Workers and guests are trying to sort out what's next. Some expect Machine to relocate. Some hope that Scape will back out of its project, allowing the club to stay. Others will find a new bar, even switching to straight bars. Machine employees continue working while they still can, ignoring what's on the horizon.
I'm Danny Wong. I'm the head of security at Machine Nightclub. This place, it's family. That's the only way I can say it. It's family.
The loss of Machine might signal progress for the LGBT community. That's because bars in Boston have become more welcoming. But it's a loss of a place that feels like home. I'm Christian Yeager.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, the work of students in the Radio Narrative Journalism course at the College of Communication. We've already heard stories about music, education, and economic stresses on culture in Greater Boston. Now we turn to religion. A growing 21st century concern is creating divisions in some churches in the U.S. It's concern over climate change. Student reporter Colby Lucas visited a church in Brookline that says caring for God's creation is a religious responsibility.
Pews start to fill up as churchgoers enter St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Older folks take the seats closer to the front, while young couples with small children hang towards the back. The room is full of quiet chatter. There are waves and smiles here and there. There's no way to tell that the church is partially powered by solar panels. The inside looks the same as it did before the solar panels were installed in 2012. The stained glass still beckons light in from outside. Reverend Jeffrey Mello is the church rector.
On January 6, 1976, the church was destroyed by fire, the sanctuary, and the only thing left standing were the exterior walls. And so the church had a decision to make whether they were going to rebuild or whether they were just going to close and move to the other Episcopal churches in Brookline.
Parishioners decided that they would rebuild.
Given that it was 1976 and then the rebuild happened finished in 1982, it was really the advent of awareness for solar power.
Solar panels have been a central part of the identity of St. Paul's congregation since they were installed after the fire. Parishioner Fred Muter helped install the solar panels.
We've got panels both on the church hall here as well as also on above the rector's office. And that actually handles about 40% of our electrical needs. It's been a real benefit. As you may know, it actually feeds directly into the power grid and actually makes our power meters spin backwards. So we're actually adding power into the grid during low usage.
Large, cavernous, and often empty, churches can be among the biggest wasters of energy in a community.
Our buildings tend to be the biggest. They tend to take the most to heat. And unfortunately, so many spaces are only used on Sunday morning. So churches could really be a major force in reducing energy use in the local community.
Reverend Mello says the solar panels are an outward and visible sign to neighbors that inside the church is a community that takes caring for the environment seriously.
When I was looking and interviewing to come here, I knew, even just looking at the building and pictures and reading on the website, that the care of creation was central to this community's ethos, that taking care of the creation was an important mandate that they took seriously.
While St. Paul's Church is addressing climate change, some churches have been slow to acknowledge the issue. As recently as 2018, a Pew survey found only 28% of white evangelicals said they believed human beings contribute to climate change, compared to 77% of Hispanic Catholics. Christians who want to address climate change are part of what's called the Creation Care Movement. It combines Christianity and environmentalism.
And the light bulb went on, and I said, I get it. You know, I'm motivated to keep and serve and take care of this creation, this environment, as a means of understanding my faith and what it meant to love God and to take care of the world that He's created.
A member of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action shares her realization of her responsibility to the environment in a short film called Evangelicals for Climate Action. The documentary was made by Boston University film professor Sam Kaufman. He says there's growing influence coming from the younger generation.
There are a lot of younger evangelicals who, you know, read the news, you know, take courses in school that are science-based, and they realize that, you know, this is a real threat to the world. And so, you know, they take an approach that's different than their parents, and they're trying to influence their parents to say, you know, the work we're doing, it's called creation care. You know, we're caring for God's creation, and God left us this great place, so we need to tend it and take care of it. So that's sort of how they're trying to push the older generation that's more conservative, that's less scientific-based, to seeing that they have a responsibility too. So it's more based on how to care for God's creation than it is about the threat of climate change.
In Brookline, St. Paul's is not alone in working to address climate change in a house of worship. Another Episcopal church, All Saints Parish, was the first church in New England to win the Environmental Protection Agency's Energy Star Award for efforts to protect the environment. It was honored for a heating project that lowered the church's environmental impact by 50%.
It's important for us to do these things, not just for how they benefit the environment here or how they benefit the church.
Again, St. Paul's Church Rector, Jeff Mello.
But the church should be a living example to the people who are in it, right? So that when our parishioners come, they learn, oh, I could do that at my house. You know, oh, that's I could have that thermostat. Oh, I could change my lighting to that.
St. Paul's is one of many churches paving the way towards a greener future. And its rector says the church is proud to set an example for everyone. I'm Colby Lucas.
At the beginning of the 20th century, Antonio Bova arrived in Boston with one dream: own and establish a family business. He settled in the North End and opened the Antonio Bova and Sons Bakery. Nearly 100 years later, his dream is still alive. Student reporter Gaia DeSimone discovered the bakery remains very much a family business.
It is midnight at Bova's Bakery. And in the back, there is an unstoppable juggling act of trays of fresh baked goods. The bakers carry cookies and treats back and forth from the countertop to the oven, ready to give them the last touch in a long preparation process.
Right now we're just stretching out the dough. The cookie's called rugola. We sell so much of this.
This is Dominic Abramo. He's Antonio Bova's great-grandson. He belongs to the third generation of the Bova family. And like most of his cousins, he grew up at the bakery, surrounded by ingredients and trays. While cutting the dough, Abramo describes his work at the bakery 4 to 5 hours at night during the week, and then usually 8 hours at least on both Friday and Saturday.
And we were hoping to get out by 12. Last night, we hoped to get out by 12. We got out at 1:30, so you just never get out early.
The fan of the refrigerator in the back of the small store is Abramo's constant companion during nights at the bakery. He typically sleeps 4 to 5 hours at night. During the day, the 29-year-old baker is an administrator at Beth Israel Lehi Health System.
My day job, I always tend to prioritize. But on the other end here, we never want to run out of stuff. We take pride in our quality and the product that we put out. So we always feel like we have one shot to capture any customer. So
Abramo has been working at the bakery every night since he finished his master's degree in 2015. He learned everything he could from one of Bova's older Italian bakers, but something more powerful kept him going.
And my grandfather died when I was 3 years old, so I didn't really get to know him, but this is really a piece of him still alive.
While Abramo decorates pink, yellow, and green champagne cookies, his cousin, Anthony Bova II, arrives. He too is juggling between nighttime at the bakery and the full-time job.
I'm an attorney, so I work at a law firm in downtown Boston. Sometimes work doesn't let me come to the bakery, but usually I try and make sure that I get here.
Well, what makes Bova's bakery unique is remaining family-owned after almost 100 years.
It keeps our family close, you know, like all our cousins, they become like brothers and sisters. I grew up an only child, but you know, we've remained so close because the bakery, we're always around each other. This was our way of bonding.
Bova's Bakery was founded in 1926 by Antonio Bova, Abramo's great-grandfather. He fled from Italy with his 5 sons. Now, the bakery's shares are owned by Abramo's family and 2 cousins. And they have an interesting system to run the business.
my grandfather came up with a system where it was he would work for 6 months and then he would take off a year while the other two brothers worked their 6 months each. Right now, actually, is my grandmother's 6 months, but I do work for all the cousins as well.
Abraham's uncle, George Bova, works at the bakery every night during his 6 months. In the day, he's an equipment operator at Logan Airport. As soon as he's done with his main job, around 11 p.m., he rushes to the family business to help baking. The bakery is his world.
Love it. Wouldn't trade it for the world. Love it. This is a god. I was lucky to be. I was blessed enough to be born into this family. Love it.
Just about all of our family works here or has worked here. Our grandmother, she's worked here her entire life. And it's our legacy. It's what our family's built, so it's very important that we keep it going.
The Bova family will pass on their legacy in the years to come. Abramo got married last year, and his cousin, Anthony Bova, has just become a father. With luck, the trays will continue their dance from the big steel countertop to the noisy old big oven for another generation, at least. I'm Gaia De Simone.
Good evening. On Boston University's World of Ideas, tonight you're hearing stories prepared by radio narrative journalism students in BU's College of Communication. Our final stories focus on what we can learn about this community and ourselves from the area's nightlife. Most people know the relief of leaving work at the end of the day and changing into clothes that help you be yourself. Such self-expression's quite a bit more complicated for those who become completely different people. Student reporter Lucy Levin has the story of some drag queens at Jacques Cabaret in Boston.
Dee Dee DeRay stands over 6 feet tall. In heels, an orange rhinestone-studded bodysuit, and a Swarovski-covered feather headpiece. Tonight, she's performing in two misleading ladies shows at Jacques Cabaret, one of Boston's oldest drag bars. She'll get home around 1:30 a.m. and wake up by 8 to start doing her makeup for drag brunch.
The weekends
are
tough.
There's a reason why we drink a lot, just to keep us going.
She's only Dee Dee in drag. On weekdays, Dee Dee becomes Donald Ray Gregorio and works at a law firm. The office means less glitz and glamour and more clients and labor laws, but she needs the income.
Reserved is more the word that, at my day job. Like, I try to be still my authentic self as far as personality-wise, but at the end of the day, like, it's a job. I get it. Like, I gotta get the job done. I went in just like, all right, I'm gonna accept this job, just knowing that I have to just act differently. If you're not a trust fund baby, you know, you gotta work to survive and put a roof over your head, so.
But at night, he transforms into Dee Dee, swapping a business suit for a low-cut leather one-piece, a Playboy bunny ear mask, sequin gloves, and boots shiny enough to catch a reflection in. At Jacques' drag shows, performers lip-sync and dance for audiences of mostly straight women, out for bridal or birthday parties. Dee Dee is a hero at the bar tonight. She leads one of the show's only male guests on stage and gives him a lap dance. The crowd screams. The audience comes to Jacques for a good time, but the drag queens are here to be who they want to be. It's more than a gig for extra cash. In drag, the queens can be themselves without worrying about whether their dresses, jokes, or dances are appropriate.
What's your name, real quick? Wendy. Hi, Wendy. Let's see the ring. How's your Joe? Wendy, you've been around. Look at that.
Christopher Fijal, better known as Chris Knievel, is coming up on her 25th anniversary of performing in her comedy queen persona.
I'm like the aggressive slut.
but funny. Each of us has our own thing. Like, some girls are sexy, some girls are dancey, some girls do, like, R&B. So, like, everyone's got their own, like, niche. Parodies and like, fun numbers like, that are more comedic is sort of my lane. If there's a cute guy in the audience, I'm going to put my boobs on his head, I'm going to take his shirt off. But it's all in the vein of making people laugh and just...
Anything goes at a drag show, and the audience is here to play along. For Knievel, drag is a labor of love, and a chance to be her most genuine self.
Putting on a costume, putting on a face, like, me out of drag is very sort of quiet, but when this armor comes on and the mask comes on, this other person that is part of me but not me can come out because I have that protection where I can be that person that I'm not in my real life.
Knievel's still adjusting to drag and new gender norms becoming more acceptable than when she started.
Like, it's just so rapidly changed so fast that I get called, like, the granny because I'm like, no, don't do that. Don't put heels on. No, don't walk around in heels if you're in your boy clothes. No, don't do that. Like, I'm so afraid someone's going to get hurt.
Knievel won't stop performing, no matter the toll it takes on her body.
I fractured my ankle, like, 2.5 years ago, so I don't wear the high stiletto high heels anymore. I wear lower, chunky lesbian heels now because my ankles can't take it, you know? And you just adjust and keep going. Like,
or she will until she can't.
Until my body falls apart and I can't walk, pretty much.
She'll keep dancing for now. She wants her chance to be on stage. I'm Lucy Levin.
Dancers who make their livings by taking off their clothes have begun organizing in some American cities to demand stronger workplace protections, in particular, protection from sexual harassment. But student reporter Rachel Kelly found the line between sexual entertainment and harassment can be a bit blurry.
Between red velvet ropes, women form a line outside the Boston nightclub 222. Inside, Men in Motion Male Strippers is set to perform. For the audience, it's a night out to celebrate impending nuptials, or just a girl's night out.
Ladies, who likes a man in uniform?
The MC of Men in Motion spends his days as a tattoo artist and children's dance instructor. He does not want parents to find out about his other job, so he asks we just use his first name, Brian. Brian says he's not sure part-time dancers deserve the same benefits offered by 9-to-5 jobs.
Yeah, heck no. I'm doing this, and I don't think I need all that. I don't think that we should be offered, unless we're performing Monday through Friday, doing rehearsals.
But Brian says it makes sense to have workplace protections against sexual harassment, since some women in the audience can get wild.
Some shows, sometimes the girls can be a little... too much, and sometimes they get a little too drunk. We're all performers, so basically you don't want to, like, yell at the girls. You just gotta remind them sometimes that, you know, there are rules.
Rules such as no scratching or grabbing dancers. This is why the author of Stripped, Inside the Lives of Exotic Dancers, says sexual harassment protections are needed in strip clubs for both audience members and dancers. The author is Bernadette Barton.
Just like any other employee, no exotic dancer should be subject to unwanted touching. Absolutely, that's wrong. It's hard to have that happen because there's a public perception that you're doing a job that entails touching, and dancers, like any other worker, should not be touched without their consent.
These rules also apply to dancers who make audience members feel uncomfortable with inappropriate touching. But audience members get no sympathy from one of the women who works at the strip club. Server Ashley Mitchell says women who buy a ticket to see a strip show should know what could happen.
They know what they're signing up for. Like, they're walking into a door where they are signing, like, basically you bought the ticket agreeing to, I want to get groped on, but that's basically what you're signing up for, to get a lap dance and get touched on sexually. Like, that's what attracts them to be here. So for anyone ever feeling comfortable, it's like, not saying like, oh, if I wear what I'm wearing, I'm asking to get grabbed on. No, that's the complete opposite. It's, I would purposely buy a ticket to go to a sex party. What do you expect to happen if you go to a sex party?
It's a good question. There could be all sorts of expectations, says author Barton. She says buying a ticket to see a strip show does not mean someone has consented to physical touch.
The female customers buying a ticket to go to see male dancers, are they signing a contract? I would say no, they're not, because they would have to know. I guess if they walk in the door and there's a big sign that says, by walking in this door, you are consenting, you know, you be warned that there may be graphic sexual touch on your body, then okay, yeah. And they saw that and they nodded their head or something as they walk in, yes. But other than that, no, I don't think it's a contract. And I would say, no, I don't think there's an implied consent by just walking through the door and buying a ticket that you're agreeing to be touched sexually.
During the show, dancers choose women from the audience to sit in what's called the hot seat. It's a chair center stage where women receive lap dances.
I do a little movement where I take my belt off and I hit the girl with the belt.
Brian says there is a kind of verbal agreement between him and the audience member.
I do a lot of moves in my routine that can be very, like, sexual, but the thing is I always tell the girl that what I'm doing, and I always ask for permission.
Whether you're in the audience or dancing on stage, clear consent is key. I'm Rachel Kelly.
The city of Boston shuts down relatively early at night, or at least in the early morning compared to many other major cities. One of the few options for people who are hungry or looking for a place to gather is the South Street Diner. Student reporter Sarah Frazier paid the diner a visit.
At 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night, South Street Diner's head server, Aurora Bari, is 1 hour into her overnight shift.
The thing is, you know what keeps me home and I don't go out? I'm very picky when I eat.
The overnight crowd is usually very social. Customers start as strangers and soon strike up conversations like old friends. Sometimes, they even start dancing to the music.
We dance too sometimes because, you know, we like to entertain our customer. Plus, they become our friends too. He comes here late night. Hi, Ari, how are you?
Ari Resnick is a regular at South Street, and he's become close with Bari. He works in the area and often finds himself at the diner around 9 or 10 o'clock.
Got a job that requires long hours sometimes, and it's just nice to walk into a place that has friendly faces that I know, and it's hard to argue when it's 24 hours and around the corner. So,
I'll do the burger with fries and a Budweiser inside, please. Thank you.
Bari is a tiny, fierce woman. She's been working at the diner for 4 years now. And she says the overnight hours can be grueling.
I'm lucky to put like 5 hours to sleep, but most of the time it's about 4 hours. I mean, it's not designed for a human being to work overnight, you know?
Most nights, Bari is running around the restaurant, taking orders and sometimes helping prep the food. Bari's in charge when the restaurant's owner, Saul, is away. She's also responsible for hiring and managing new employees. And that's no easy feat at a diner that never closes.
Jackie, can you please check on my table 3?
The diner's location on busy Neyland Street attracts, let's say, an eclectic clientele.
We're not far from South Station, so we get crowds from around the world. You know, I mean, we get people from lawyers from the top all the way to the bottom, meaning like drug dealers and pimps. And, of course, we're in the business of serving everybody, you know.
And everybody includes drunk nightclub and partygoers. Bijou Nightclub is just down the street, and another club called The Grand is also close by. When the clubs close, the drunk crowds flock to South Street Diner.
We're like the last stop. There's nothing else. There's no booze getting served anymore. They drank all night, or they try to bring in alcohol.
That's Jacqueline Robertson, another server who frequently works the graveyard shift.
Let me give you this before I forget.
While most restaurants have security only in the form of cameras and alarms, The diner needs outside security contractors to protect employees. The workers joke about a night when two customers attempted to avoid paying their bill by claiming the man next to them was planning to pay for them. He wasn't. Then that same man left a tip, which one of the problematic patrons tried to steal. Bari called security, and moments later, there was a full-blown fight.
I'm like, my God, this woman is so strong. Then she threw the security to the counter, and then the hair fell off. Oh my God, there was not a woman, there was a guy. So I'm like, no wonder they were so strong, and everybody was laughing, and I'm like, I don't need to watch Jerry Springer's show, it's right here.
Most times, the problems aren't as drastic as physical violence. Drunk people are often annoying nuisances rather than security threats.
I just had someone who walked out on his bill, was so out of his tree, he came back, ordered the same thing. And literally, I was like, oh, you didn't cover your bill. You still owe for... I didn't order that. I didn't eat here.
Coping with these situations requires a lot of experience, practice, and patience.
If you want to work here overnight, patience is your main key. If you can handle pressure, then you cannot be in here.
Drunk and aggressive customers are a definite downside to the job. One of the major upsides to working at South Street Diner, the friendly regulars.
No, the guy, you remember the guy who was from Saudi used to come in here?
You always talk about this guy. You get jealous.
Oh, don't get jealous.
Resnick takes a seat on a stool by the counter and chats with Bari. Just two old friends catching up about their weeks. He mentions his upcoming trip to Japan. So she chooses a song on the touchscreen jukebox just for him. It's called Big in Japan. Bari has worked at other diners, but South Street is the only one that feels like home.
It's fun. We turn the jukebox on, and it's a different atmosphere. You feel like you're in another nightclub. You feel like you just left one nightclub and you went to another one.
It's this unique atmosphere that makes working until dawn bearable and keeps Boston's hungry masses coming in for a late-night bite. I'm Sarah Fraser.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the work of journalism students in BU's College of Communication class on radio narrative journalism. Stories were edited by BU professor Ann Donahue and assembled by Michael Garth and Paul Kahlo. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to WBUR.org to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.